do. I walk that wire and I take that step. Won't look down, got no regrets. Won't look down, got no regrets. I was made for this.
Welcome to the Tyler and Kelly Show, a podcast created for the leaders and entrepreneurs of today. My name is Tyler Dickerhoff, and this episode is part of our Impact Maker series, where each week I will profile a different leader who is making a profound impact in our world and our community. We discuss their leadership styles, lessons they've learned, as well as any tips and tricks they have to grow your leadership. My mission is to take what they say and apply it directly to network marketing, allowing you to strengthen and expand your own business.
Welcome, guys. I am super excited to have this guest with us today, Dr. Lance Fox. Lance and I have known each other. I was counting that up. He knows me from when I had hair, and there's a few that do. And a lot of people probably have no idea who my guest is, but as I just shared with him, when I started this podcast, he was one of a couple three that I was just so excited to sit down and talk with because of the impact he's made in the world. The things he has accomplished, which is a limited few that have done what he has done. So real quick, give you a little background. I'm going to let Lance dig into it deeper and better. Lance was a professional veterinarian. That's how he and I met. He was in technical services for a company when I was a dairy nutritionist. Along the way, he had the opportunity to climb Mount Everest. And he's one of a very few that have been able to summit. He is proud owner of the highest cheesehead in the world. We'll get into that. And with that process, he started an organization called Healthy Yak. Healthy Yak was kind of started to support the Nepalese and the Sherpas and their animals there. And I'm going to let him talk about that and its evolution over time and where that's at now. So here we go. Another bald guy. Another bald man who God chose to have limited growth on the top of our head. Lance, thank you for joining me.
Yeah, thanks for having me. I appreciate the invite. It's good to see you again.
You too. It's been a little while, but it's one of those things. I think whether it's kindred spirits at times, whether it's people that connect, and the ability to have years in between as our careers have changed, and don't have as much FaceTime as what we used to, or times to talk. I'm excited about this. So I kind of queued up a little bit more of your background. Why don't you take an opportunity to kind of sprinkle in a little bit more of the pertinent information for our listeners that probably have no mountaineering background, no veterinary, no animal agriculture background. Kind of, give us a little bit richer flavor of who Lance Fox is.
Yeah, absolutely. And I appreciate the salutation and the greeting. I always tell people I go to bed Lance, I wake up Lance, so everybody should just call me Lance, right? Or as I hear some of my European colleagues call me Lance, so I'm happy with both pronunciations. But I'm a humble guy from central Wisconsin originally. I grew up working on a small dairy farm, about a 34-cow dairy. So I'm very ingrained in the agricultural industry. I graduated in 1995 from the University of Wisconsin-Madison School of Veterinary Medicine, and I practiced for 4 years. I got out of practice because I wanted to do a little bit more with my mind, a little less with my hands, so to say. And I probably should back up one step. I actually met my wife in veterinary school, and she's a horse veterinarian, still in private practice, and does some other work for a large foundation for Friesian horses. So we're very much entrenched into the animal world, if you will. But I got into the industry and through various roles, and as you mentioned, met you back in about 2002, 2003, somewhere in there roughly. Mm-hmm. And we've stayed connected. Like you said, at times we have some distance, but life gets busy. But great to get reconnected. My career has taken me through roles of sales to national account management. Currently, I work for a company called DSM. People really don't know much about the company. We're actually the world's largest vitamin manufacturer for both humans and animals. We have multiple business units. For instance, I'm looking at my Mac here. I have an iPhone, iPad. The plastics on those devices come from my company. We have a contract with Apple. So many facets to the company, not just nutrition based. But I work here in North America primarily. I am the director of technical services for DSM in our animal nutrition and health business unit. I have about 20 to 21 people on my team. They culminate from PhDs in nutrition to veterinarians on the nutrition side of the business. I also have some laboratory scientists and then people with their masters and then some that have been out in the working world managing, say, big dairies. But I oversee our dairy, beef, poultry, and swine technical services group here in North America. And I've been with DSM about four and a half years right now. Actually reside near what I call hallowed ground, which is Lambeau Field, about 50 minutes southwest of Green Bay, Wisconsin. So yes, I'm a devout cheesehead, and we'll talk about that more a little bit later.
Yeah, for sure. So one of the things that I like to do here to help people, one, these are kind of arcane questions, a little fun. It's called the hot seat questions, five questions I'm going to ask you. And it's something that we could dive into a little bit deeper. If you know, we find something that kind of hits a note, then we'll go down that path. So first question, who would I choose to spend tomorrow, as if I could choose with anyone in the world?
So you're asking who would I choose tomorrow? Okay. Well, you know, I'm going to go back just a little bit deeper, and this is probably going to dive us into why I climbed Everest, which is actually a couple of reasons, but, I lost my father back when I was 16, so I'm going to be 48 soon. And he was a young man. He was 36, died of cancer. Every day I wish I had him back. So I'm going to answer it that way. I would love to sit and chat with him directly tomorrow.
And I know that's a real tie to why you ended up climbing Everest. So we'll circle back to that one. What have you tried for the first time within the last year?
For the first time in the last year? That's a good hot seat question. Well, so I actually just occurred this week. I took a couple days vacation time. I actually was a little bit nervous, a great, great thing that we did. I have some land about 45 minutes away, about 190 acres, and I put together some training grounds for our local police and military, and it's just my little give back to those who serve us. It's a fun time for them, fun time for me, and I was allowed to participate in some of that with some of the local SWAT team. So very interesting ordeal, let's just put it that way. Interesting group of guys, and I really, really enjoyed their company. Yeah. So that was completely new to me.
That's awesome, man. What historical event would you love to be a part of?
I'm looking at a picture. That's what I'm looking up on the wall here. You know, again, it's going to sound military-wise, but it's just a little bit more hidden meaning here. I'm looking back at the Revolutionary War and some 13, 14 individuals that stood their ground against 300-400 other individuals. And it's not always about size, right? It's about that leadership, the drive, the resilience, as you mentioned earlier when we were talking. But it'd be an interesting time just to take a hovercraft and necessarily kind of watch. You don't have to be right entrenched in it, right? But just to see, how did perseverance play out? And that's one of things I think about.
Oh, that's awesome. What did the 10-year-old you want to be?
I wanted to be an astronaut.
An astronaut, okay.
I actually wrote to NASA, believe it or not, when I was about that age.
Really? Yeah. I'll share this. The 10-year-old me wanted to be a veterinarian. And then I got into my first semester at Cornell, and that ended quickly.
That ended quickly.
So you've accomplished something that is a bucket list item, right?
Correct.
Climbing Everest.
Correct.
What's at the top of your bucket list now?
You know, so yeah, and I'll change that a little bit. The question I get asked that's very similar is, what do you want to do next, right? And that's kind of a similar question. So I'm a pretty content guy. I've never had the intent to go climbing all over the world. I've climbed 14, 15 different peaks, but it's never been one of those goals, right? You mentioned the Healthy Act Project, and we'll dive into that in a little while, I'm sure. I'm all about nurturing other people, helping other people. It's a bit of that drive. Maybe that's why we've got cops in the family and some of those things and where my kids are headed. But I had the Healthy Act Foundation. We'll talk about that shortly. But I've actually joined a new nonprofit called Black Dog Rescue. It's a nonprofit that goes around the world doing vaccination and neuter spay clinics to control dog populations, promote health in impoverished areas. So For me, it's about giving back, right? We're pretty fortunate in this world. I think it's one of the reasons I've gone back to Nepal so many times. It's a humbling event to go and see a people that live on less than $1,000 a year, right? And they're happy. And for me, there's a lot of meaning to that. They want a shirt on their back, clothes, you know, food on the table, shelter over their head. But I tell you, they're just a happy people. And so it tells me simple is okay, right? And so if I can give back to some of those people that are in need and make them a little more happy, that's I'm very enriched by that.
What do you think that, like, that servant heart, that servant leadership, that that really comes from?
Foundation. I give a lot of credit to my mother. God bless her. She's still alive, doing well. My father, for sure. 16 wonderful years. No regrets along the way. Gave me a great foundation. Kind of gave me that spring pad to launch. And I think just learn, life is short, right? We're only here for a set time on this planet. And it varies, right? So let's make the most of every minute we're here. I think really that, it's going to sound ironic, but having lost him at such a young age, I think that really, that happened for a reason, right? I had to grow up pretty quickly. I'm still growing up, by the way. And that's a great thing. You know, we learn every day, and that's the beauty of life. You learn something every day, and you should. I think that's really what set that stage.
So, you know, as we talk about your dad and kind of transition now to the choice to climb Everest, and, you know, talk about how he instilled that in you as a young child, and then when you became a father, and just kind of that transition and how leading to Everest.
It's a perfect segue right there, Tyler. So as you heard, my dad died when I was 16, and I became a father back in 1997. I was a young man myself, and a bit ironic, you know, just like everybody, we learn Everest is the highest point in the planet. We typically learn that in high school, right? Pick up a geography book, whatever. And in 1997, I was out in private practice second year. My wife and I are renting a home. We still had quite a debt from veterinary school. We were practicing about 2.5 hours southeast of Madison. Our son Jordan decided to come out 6 weeks early. So he was a preemie. And because of his prematurity, he didn't have enough surfactant, which is the chemical in your lungs to let you breathe and let out that first big cry. He didn't have enough of that surfactant, so he was taken up to a NIC unit, a level 4 NIC unit, neonatal intensive care unit, back in Madison, Wisconsin, and he spent 11 days in an incubator. And because my wife and I didn't have a lot of money at the time, we actually got into the local Ronald McDonald House in Madison for about $10 a night. And one day, as we're watching Jordan with his struggles with all the tubes in him and his breathing, my wife looked at me. She says, "Lance, let's go to the bookstore. And let's just get a book so we can keep our minds on something else other than constantly on Jordan." So I happened to pick up a book on the end of a shelf called Everest, Mountain Without Mercy, written by the National Geographic Channel. And some people may have heard of the story Into Thin Air, which was a movie, was a book by John Krakauer. It's a similar story, but based on the National Geographic input. I became enamored with Everest reading that book. And I remember reading it in 2 days. And I closed the last page. And I remember quietly saying to myself as I sat in that Ronald McDonald House room, "Someday I'm going to go try and climb this mountain." I had never climbed before. I was an avid outdoorsman. My dad was an avid outdoorsman, but he was not a climber. And it just stuck, right? And through the process of keeping that dream alive inside me, it took a long time to get to Everest. I didn't climb it till 2009. I'd done some climbing prior. Thought a lot about my dad along the way in his short life on this earth. And so the drive was, the book started the dream, watching Jordan's struggles, and he came out of it. He's a healthy sophomore in college. He's about 2 inches taller than me. I'm 6 foot, and he's a nice brawny boy. He's a good kid. And I carried some of my dad's ashes to the summit of Everest and released those at the summit. And the drive was to pay homage to him, and then also to show my kids dreams come true. You just got to want it bad enough. You're going to probably have to make some sacrifice along the way, but hard work, and you'll get there.
So, I mean, obviously this book lit a fire in you. I mean, yeah. You said you're outdoorsman, but you're not a mountaineer. Correct. And, you know, from what little bit I understand, You know, you could go climb, you know, some 7,000, 8,000, 10,000 foot peaks, and that's just kind of, you know, getting your feet wet. You know, here you are, and yeah, it was over a, you know, 12-year period. I should say we're almost to your anniversary. May 21st, 2009, you were able to put your flag in your cheese head on top of Mount Everest, which again, still astounds me. Because I see the trials and tribulations of people getting there, and you don't have to read many books to understand how few and far between it is. But, you know, you accomplished something that very few have, but also to an elite, you know, physical level. And so talk about those challenges along the way and why you still had, I mean, you had to have numerous challenges in the training process, much less when you were there in Nepal, but why you chose to be resilient.
Yeah. So, you know, Everest, not unlike other mountains, depending on altitude and the degree of toughness, if you will, Mount Rainier, Mount McKinley, et cetera. Yeah. There's the physical demand, correct? I often, when I do my public speaking on the trip, I say, you know, I jokingly say, it's not like you can be 1,000 pounds and be a chain smoker. The odds are a little bit more against you, right? So yeah, you have to prepare yourself physically, and we can certainly talk about that in a minute. But I'll be honest with you, like a lot of challenges, Everest is mental. It is mental. And I actually watched not only teammates, but I watched people from other expeditions come to the mountain, take one look at it and say, I'm not doing this. Just the mental aspect, right? There are some dangers on the mountain, and your psyche is played with a little bit, right? Did I have rough days? Oh yeah. I had days where I'm like, what am I doing here, right? But then you remember why you're here. It's that drive to try and finish that task. It wasn't always about the summit. It was about the attempt to get to the summit, right? And obviously the goal is to get home to family and friends with all your fingers and toes intact. That's really the ultimate goal. But, you know, there were days where you gut it out, embrace the suck, as we often hear, and you put one foot in front of the other. I think one thing I've learned in climbing, which I think is a great analogy in life, we were always told, don't look at the summit. That summit could be 2 miles away, and it was 2.2 miles higher than base camp. It's a long ways up. Don't look at the summit. Look at the rock 100 yards ahead, 100 meters ahead. Get to that next rock. Once you reach that rock, now you look to the next rock, right? And so you have goals amongst goals, right? Waypoints, segue points. And so, yeah, it's an interesting mental battle that you just have to gut it out and realize everything's going to be okay. Positive spirit versus negativity, I guess, for lack of a better term. Physically, yeah, let's go back to that for a minute. Training for Everest was interesting. I had been climbing for about 3 years prior to Everest. Highest I had been is about 19,000 feet. Everest is 29,035 feet, or if you want meters, 8,848. I didn't know what my body was going to do at altitude. Normally, you would climb 7, 8, maybe 10 years before you make an attempt on Everest for those that want to do it. An opportunity arose in the spring of 2008 to join an expedition in 2009. The following spring. So I had 1 year to train, and I trained on a little local hill about 5 minutes from my home. It's about 150 feet high. It's a daunting 960 feet above sea level at the top. And yeah, load up my pack, put on my gear, and go up and down that little peak all day on the weekends. When I wasn't traveling for my job during the week, I'd be out there at night. Winter storm would come, 2 in the morning, headlamp, head on over to the hill. So physical conditioning, eat right, exercise right, but the mental aspect is important too. Get the frame of mind right.
How has that mental aspect changed who you are?
Well, I have a even more renewed embrace of life. I saw death on the mountain. There are bodies up there. People often ask why. There's an unspoken rule in, spoken rule, but unwritten rule. Let's rephrase that. When you die above 8,000 meters climbing, you're typically going to be left there. It's just too dangerous to bring corpses down. It is cryotherapy. The bodies stay there forever. There's lack of oxygen. It's cold. Humbling to see that. And one of the individuals I saw was Scott Fisher, who died in the 1996 into thin air disaster. He's a famous mountain guide back then. Yeah, it's a humbling moment to look at that. And it reminds you of the fragility of life, and it sets in motion in you that live life every day to the fullest. I'd been doing that, but boy, that was a real eye opener for me that this is real. This isn't a game. And we try to instill in our kids, just live your life every day. Does that mean we're not going to have bad days? Absolutely not. I have bad days. Absolutely. Wake up and go, ah, I don't want to go to work today, right? But you get up and you do it, right? And it's that internal drive in us, that flame.
So you had the opportunity while you were, you said you got chosen to be a part of an expedition, one that was aired on, TV. It's on Netflix that people can go and watch season 3 when you're on there and your quest to the summit. Tell us about Russell Bryson. Tell us about the leadership. I mean, he's one of the most renowned, guides as far as mountaineering. Yeah. And, as we kind of use this opportunity to talk about leadership, I'd love to hear, someone that literally has your life in his hands. The character of leadership that he showed you.
Yeah, I think that's a fantastic question, and I haven't had that question in a while. Russell Bryce is a Kiwi. He's from New Zealand. He's summited Everest a couple times. He's done multiple 8,000 meter plus peaks successfully. It's interesting. We go back when I accepted the challenge to join his expedition in 2009. My wife had a long talk about this dream, and of course Everest brings the connotation of death and danger, right? Hollywood's done a good job of that, right? And you'll see the reports now of Everest coming out in the news, because this is the climbing season. They're gearing up for summit attempts here in the coming days when the winds are right. Russell Bryce is a very short-spoken, soft-spoken Kiwi. And the reason for that, we had a very large expedition. We had 29 paid Westerners, which is a very big team. You have your support staff, so you've got a 1-to-1 Sherpa ratio, unlike some other expeditions where it may be 1-to-3. So we each had our own Sherpa up high on the mountain, typically from about Camp 4, which is at just about 8,000 meters, 26,200 feet for English. And he paid attention to the details because of what you just said. He has never lost a Westerner. He has lost a Sherpa due to some unforeseen ailment, a genetic ailment that was not predictable at altitude. But we kind of stacked the odds in our favor when I joined on with Russell Bryce. I'd watched him in the Discovery Channel series from, I think, 2006 and 2007. In 2008, the Chinese had closed down the border, so there was no climbing allowed on the north side. So Discovery did not air in that year, and that's why they came back to film the third and final season in 2009 when I was there. And I just kind of had this rapport with Russell, but his style of leadership, again, soft-spoken, but very direct. And he did something very unique in the history of climbing Everest on the south side, which is Nepal. Normally, when you get to Everest Base Camp, which is about a 9 to 10 day trek from the village of Lukla, where we land by airplane or helicopter, you're sitting at base camp at about 18,000 feet above sea level, 3,000 feet higher than the highest point in the United States of America. And normally what you do is you rest for a few days, and then you start going up Everest, and you make rotations. You go up, and you might go to 20,000 feet and come back down and rest. You go back up, and you go to 20, 21, maybe up to 23,000 feet, sleep a night or two, come all the way back down. It's a lot of repetitive rotation work. And so what we're doing is a process known as acclimatization. Russell knew there were some very distinct dangers on the south side of Everest on the lower portion of the climb, which is called the Khumbu Icefall. You may recall back a few years ago, there was a massive icefall that killed 16 Sherpas. It was the year prior to the big Everest earthquake that happened in Nepal. Okay. This icefall, the analogy I use, is just like in Alaska with the glaciers flowing into the ocean, into the Bering Sea. Those glaciers are breaking apart and you have big chunks of ice falling into the ocean, right? On Everest, it's the same process, but on dry land. That glacier up high, it starts at about 22,000 feet, is 3,000 to 4,000 feet thick of ice, and gravity's pulling it down. As it comes to the lower altitude but warmer temperatures, it breaks apart, forming this icefall. And that unfortunately happened in 2015, I believe, when that massive icefall released on those Sherpa. He wanted to keep us out of that. And so we minimized our rotations on Everest. But to do our acclimatization, we traveled 5 miles back down the valley to climb a peak called Lobosheh. Lobosheh is the height of Mount McKinley or Denali up in Alaska, but it's a baby peak in the Himalayas. We climbed that twice, sleeping at the summit crest one night. That's leadership, innovation. He came up with a novel idea to keep us safe off the icefall, but yet get our rotation in the preparation to actually go for the summit 40-some days after arriving in base camp. But yeah, very short-spoken, soft. But when he talked, you listened, right? He commanded respect. Not arrogant. Some people might take that as arrogancy. Not at all. He vividly cared for us. I remember before we left on our final pitch for the summit, we sat in our communal tent. We called it the Tiger Dome. It had a fake tiger rug on the floor. I'll never forget it. And he had tears in his eyes because he said, "I'm sending you off to war. I don't know who's coming back." And he really genuinely cared for us. And that's part of leadership too, caring for your people. You may not always verbalize it along the way until that right moment. And that was his style. And we had an extremely successful season. Out of the 29 of us, 20 of us made it up. Historically on Everest in a given season, 40 to 42% of people make it up. We were well beyond 50%. Interesting little other side fact. Out of the 29 of us, 15 of us were first-timers like me. I tell you what, only 20% of first-timers make it up. Almost all of us made it up. Pretty incredible odds. So he really put together a fascinating team of support staff, the climbers themselves. Yes, there's that individual drive, but you do work as a team, essentially, to get up to the summit of Everest. Yeah, fantastic.
How has that example really altered your life?
So one of the things that I have tried to do with my style of leadership with my team, doing this now for 4.5 years with this team of professionals, is you lead by example, and we hear that all the time, right? And we do have to live by that mantra, but I dig a little deeper with my people, and I try to bring out not only what's in the best of them, but I've got people I'm nurturing to take over my position. That might sound a little scary, right? But we identify talent, and we want those people to get to our position because we're not going to be here forever. I'd like to be around for a while yet, right? But I want to nurture that talent in those individuals. And I think Russell was doing that with us. I'll go back to me as a specific example. Because of the size of our expedition, we had two teams. We couldn't all be up on the same rope. It was too dangerous. We ultimately had a fast team and a slower team. And you want to keep people kind of together on the mountain. And interesting, I had gotten sick on the walk into base camp. I lost about 8 pounds when I arrived into base camp. Violently ill from altitude sickness. Thought my trip was over. I was nurtured back through rest. And eventually, Russell saw that I was speeding up. And so he put me on the faster team. Still was the slowest on the fast team, but that's okay. It's not always about first place. It's about getting to the end of the voyage. And you have to be insightful, right? You have to watch your people, identify their strengths, but also capitalize on their weaknesses, grow their weaknesses so they actually become even stronger. And that's the style of management that I particularly use with leadership.
So, you know, I've learned this much myself, you know, the mentors that I've had, and you share a prime example of it with Russell. Leaders care, and leaders have tremendous compassion. What are some of the things that, you know, you were on the mountain for an extended period of time in regards to base camp, all those other things. Mm-hmm. You know, what did Russell do to learn more about why you were there that was another example of leadership?
Yeah, you mentioned the cheesehead earlier. That was one thing that always got in Russell's side. He couldn't believe I brought a big Fomation cheesehead. We always had some jokes about that. And he might take stabs at you, and because of his short-spoken style, you kind of go, gosh, is he mad? What's going on with this guy? But deep down, he has a real good spirit about him. He's got a good sense of humor. And he'd come over and make conversation about that. What are you doing with that thing? You know, why would you take that up there? You know, so he gets to know you in his own style, right? And so he does try to spend time with each individual person. But what he also does that I think is unique to leadership in management, if you will, there's when you have your leader, right? Say a CEO of a company, but then you have sub managers, correct? People that might report to that CEO. those sub managers and have people reporting to them. It's that tree, right? And what I often see happen is Russell would hold his meetings with the guides, the professional guides, the base camp doctor, our lead Sherpa, and those individuals would engage us and get to know us, and they take that information back to Russell. Because as you might imagine, it can be hard for one individual to spend time with, you know, 79, 80 people when he's worrying about everybody's lives. He's watching the weather forecast. He's making sure the ropes are getting fixed on the mountain properly, taking care of a lot of different people, not to mention the Discovery Channel people that were in their own tent and we had to cater to them too, and some very good people, by the way. But I think it's really taking your style of your leadership, your mentoring, as you said, and allowing your people under you to become mentors as well. I think leadership, we have to be very careful because there can be dictatorship, right? And dictatorship doesn't work. You don't have the buy-in of from top to bottom, because I don't think it should be run from top to bottom. It should be run from bottom up. Mm-hmm. You know, people in the trenches, per se. And I saw Russell do that. He commanded of us to have the mental fortitude. He would challenge us individually, but also have that team spirit. And that's why we had the two teams called the Yaks and the Yetis, appropriately. So
you talk about Yaks, and that was, you know, you had the opportunity. I learned this from you, how expensive, the adventure to Everest is, which makes sense. And it's a large financial contribution, and you were able to kind of creatively get sponsorship and, you know, turn it into something. You know, we go back to giving and service. So here, enter the Yaks.
Enter the Yaks. Yeah, my beloved Yaks. As a veterinarian, obviously, I'm very devoted to the health and well-being of animals, took an oath to that and live by that every day. In 2008, when I accepted the bid to climb Everest in 2009, right away, my wheels started turning about the Sherpa people. And there's a little misconception about the word Sherpa, so I'll clarify that right off the bat. In the country of Nepal on the south side, there's about 130 ethnic cultures. Sherpa is just a culture. They all don't climb. They happen to live at the foot of Everest. They came over from Tibet hundreds and hundreds of years ago, four families. All Sherpa descend from four families. They're all pretty much related. And one of the things I often share, whether I'm speaking at a school, a business function, church, whatever, the average non-climbing Sherpa, which is the majority, make and live on about $750 annually. That's U.S. dollars. So I challenge people, pull out your iPhone or your Droid, pull out your Xbox, your PlayStation, whatever the analogy is, and I want you to live on that for a year. It doesn't mean they don't want certain things, but the basic things of shelter, clothing, food, very important to them. The men and women that climb Everest and other big peaks in the Himalayas, they do so for one primary reason. They do raise more money. The average Sherpa salary, if you will, for climbing Everest is about $5,000, and that's a give or take number, not including their tips from the Westerners, etc. They use that money to send their kids to Kathmandu for a better education. They don't want their kids to be climbers. That's really their ultimate goal. There have been some great foundations to increase the education of those children in the valley that leads up to Everest called the Khumbu Valley. But a lot of those Sherpa, they want to send their kids to a better life, essentially, down the road. It's an interesting environment. The Yaks are a very strong part of their livelihood. They use the Yaks for portering goods between villages. They do use the hair, the wool to make some clothing and some things, but they also use the female yaks, which are called naks, N-A-K-S, and they milk those naks by hand in a bucket, and they use that milk to make cheese. They don't drink the milk, but they make cheese for a food source. And my wheels started turning back in 08 to try to do something for those yaks. And so through some creativity, as you mentioned, I was able to get some donated product, a dewormer. People wonder what a dewormer is. If you have a dog at home and you may be giving your dog a once a month tablet for heartworm, you're deworming your dog is what you're doing. I'm doing it in a little different fashion with the Yaks and a little different product. And so I was able to institute a program in the Yaks prior to climbing Everest. We did about 200 Naks and Yaks, and I taught the Sherpa how to deworm their Yaks with a very safe oral suspension product. And when I got home from Everest in June, in about July, I got an email from Russell Grice, and he said, Lance, those yaks and knacks that you treated, they're making more milk for the people. The people that milk the yaks, typically the women, because the men are off climbing, the women noticed a visible difference in the volume of milk. So then, of course, the wheels got turning harder in my head, and I launched the official project called Healthy Yak, yak being an iconic term. The project expanded to include the horses and the dogs and the chickens and the pigs and the sheep and everything that's found in that valley. And for the last 7 years, it actually became a nonprofit 501c3. So a very valuable contribution to just give back without profiting. And we've touched thousands of animals, thousands of Sherpa people. And it's been a wonderful, wonderful adventure to go back multiple times to Nepal, ship multiple products to Nepal, everything from exam gloves, syringes, antibiotics, wound care therapy, you name it, we buy it, we ship it over, and it's been a wonderful, wonderful adventure.
So, I mean, and these were items that, you know, commonplace in the U.S. You talk about the comparison to a pet, a dog, and you can go to a veterinarian. And I know this from history, you know, working in agriculture, you know, veterinarian supplies, all that stuff. The Nepalese people, the Sherpas, they didn't have any of this. This was all new technology that, you know, through your foundation, you're able to make an impact. And, you know, I mean, that's what this series is called. And that's what it's near and dear to my heart is people that are using examples of leadership in some way, same shape or form to make an impact. And, you know, you mentioned the thousands of people. Dude, I love it. And that's why I wanted to talk to you about it, because I think it's something that, you know, we can look around and we can say different ideas. And I think what's cool here is you took a passion and you were able to make an impact along that passion that other people would have glossed over because it's not feeding starving children in some country, but yet you were affecting a next generation. Yeah.
Well, if I can expand on it, and I appreciate that. That's exactly the drive. When I started this foundation, I reached out to the Nepali Veterinary Agency, which is located one valley to the west of Everest, and they admitted they had never serviced the Khumbu Valley. It's that remote. The trek into the Khumbu Valley is hard. It's 38 miles of up and down. You climb about a mile and a half in gain to get to the final villages, so it's not something you just get in your car and drive to, right? There are no roads. And fortunately for me, I believe, you know, God does work in mysterious ways, but I also believe he guides in a certain direction. I met a young man in 2009 when I was at the foot of Everest who ended up becoming such a pivotal part of this program. His name is Beshkamir. He's a trained veterinary animal ag technician, but he does almost the same things I do as a veterinarian here in the U.S. He can do surgery. He does shots. He diagnoses, and he had very little. They do not send supplies up to that valley. He often has to dip into his pocket to try and get basic things like penicillin or a sedative, a syringe, a needle. And I automatically could see this gentleman would help this project. And he has. He keeps track of a spreadsheet for me, tells me which villages and which animals have been treated. And so we log all that. And I tell you, it's been wonderful to teach him, to guide him through some of the things we use here in the U.S. and other countries, you know, other prospering countries. It's been a wonderful thing to watch him develop as well, you know, and he's really taken the project and done a lot of things for it.
So one thing I think as we wrap up this part about the Healthy Yak program is that, you know, as you made me aware, as I'm aware, unfortunately, the program was not able to survive. Yep. You want to go through that a little bit?
Yeah, absolutely. So I tell people it's me, myself, and Irene, right? I started this foundation. Yes, because of a 501c3, I had a board. My wife sat on as a fellow veterinarian. I had the local banker as our treasurer. Interesting enough, you meet people on planes. I fly a lot for my job, and I met a guy. I had my wristband on, which says no place but up, and had my website, and he leaned over the back seat of my plane, and he goes, "What's that wristband?" So I explained it to him. Well, it turns out, Mark Cohen's a FedEx pilot and became a board member. And little did I know, his wife is a veterinarian in Colorado. She came with my wife and I to Nepal in 2014. And then I had one of my Everest teammates help manage our website and sat on the board. And so they were my side support, if you will. But lots of causes out there, right? There are lots of causes that help in the Khumbu Valley of Nepal. And but we raised about $60,000 in the last 10 years. I figured we estimated $20,000 to $30,000 in free donated goods as well. With all that, you're looking at close to $100,000, and it costs money to send supplies, buy the supplies, send them over. Unfortunately, in Nepal, a lot of the good that you do up in the mountains gets superseded down in the valley, and it's a very unregulated country from a governmental standpoint, very chaotic, sadly. And so I would get hit with heavy taxation in Kathmandu, and the product would arrive at the airport. And ultimately, funds were just getting harder and harder to raise. And so I decided to close the foundation because I didn't want to see money going into the pocket of some individual at the airport. It was meant for the people up higher and their animals. But the good out of all of this is that even though the Healthy Yak Foundation just closed here a few weeks ago, I've joined a new 501c3 foundation out of Colorado called Black Dog Rescue. And we'll continue doing our work in impoverished areas just with a little bit different creature.
Yeah, awesome. So, you know, let's talk. It's, you know, I mentioned this earlier. It's almost 9 years to the day of your summit, that anniversary. You know, what has life, you know, taught you over those 9 years? If you look back to that journey of, you know, the training and everything else, if you can distill back. And, you know, distill back what positive changes it's made in you and how you've actively looked at things different, you know, how would you wrap all that in a package?
Yeah, you know, so the way I answer that typically, Tyler, is my daughter's 18. She's going to graduate from high school here shortly. My son is a sophomore in college. He'll be 21 in the fall. So they were young. They were 9 and 11 when I went to climb Everest. And it was hard leaving them. That was one of the sacrifices I had the biggest challenge with, right? But I called him every day, did Skype with him from the mountain. We did video just like you and I are doing. So I stayed in touch with him. And I always reminded them that no matter what their dreams are, go for it, right? I have stuck with that mantra to date. People often ask me, do my kids want to climb? My son does a little rock climbing. Maybe he has an interest, but it wasn't about that, right? It was about nurturing their dreams. I always tell everybody from my kids on through that, someday you're going to have that spark moment. That book was my spark moment, right? You need to hold on to that spark moment. Dreams don't happen overnight. You can hear the cliche, dreams, any dream is possible. Yeah, it could be, right? I don't know that I'll ever get to Mars. It'd be cool to be an astronaut, you know, but it's cool to have dreams. But it's the journey to try, right? You may not always accomplish the dream. It's the journey to try that counts. That really is truly what it's about. And so I have tried every day. And I mentioned it earlier. Yeah, there's days I wake up and go, oh, you know, another day, right? That's normal life. That's normal life. Shouldn't fool that. But why not be positive? Make something positive out of the negative, right? Yeah, you might have to have your moment of error, you know, but that's okay. That's what life's about. And so trying to always remind what I'm, whether with friends, family, colleagues, try to think about how do we spin that to a positive? And that's really what it's about. And I think that just sets us on a better path in life. That's kind of how I go about it.
You know, so as we kind of wrap up here, and again, I'm so thankful for this opportunity to catch up. I think there's so many great lessons here. And, you know, we talk about care and compassion as leaders. We talk about the desire for, you know, to have resilience, just keep going. And, you know, there's, as your book is No Place But Up, there's no place to go but up. And, you know, that's your personal decision to, you know, and I think you captured it great. You're looking up this, you know, 2 miles above you peak, and you're like, you know what, I can just take one step, focus on that rock right in front of me, and then the next rock in front of that, and there's going to be, you know, ups and downs, but you're just focusing on that next thing in front of you, and then you'll get there. And I think those are great examples in, you know, any industry. You know, as we talk about network marketing here specifically and how to apply that, you got to care about people. You got to move around the people. You know, one of the examples in leadership that I always think about is Jesus. And I think this is another example of that is, you know, you work with those around you, but you care about everyone. And, you know, I think this is, I've enjoyed this time. I appreciate you coming on, sharing about your experience to go to Everest and all those nuggets that all of us can learn from. Parting words, anything you want to share before we sign off here, Lance?
I think you stole the words out of my mouth. I mentioned the wristband and you just said it. I do try to live by that mantra. I trademarked that phrase a few years back and I try to live by that every day. No place but up. It applies. I when I'm in sales meetings, like, hey, you want more sales? No place but up. You know, we have a chuckle about that. But if you wake up, you find yourself having a bad day, tomorrow's a better day. You just got to want it and drive towards it. And that's what I'll end with. No place but up. Absolutely, Tyre. I really appreciated the time here with you today. It's good to see you, my friend.
Thank you. You too, man. And I hope that our listeners got something good out of this. I know I did. And thank you so much. And until next time, man, hopefully soon. Thank you. If you enjoyed the musical selection, it's Made for This by Carrollton. Check out their music on iTunes or wherever you get your music. Also, check out their website and look for the opportunity to partner with them in Food for the Hungry. We love their music and we love their cause and they're true impact makers.